that the commission had drawn in part on these for staff statements during the investigation that were read at the hearings and for some of the final report. But it says the commission does not endorse these monographs as official record. That suggests to me that there was a lack of consensus, even though we're given this bipartisan consensus decision at the top, between the investigative teams, at least on some issues, and the commission staff. And that's an area, I think, of fruitful inquiry. This also has no index. There is an online index at Vivissimo that's very useful, where you can pull up a term and get it by paragraph and where it appears in the report. The hardback edition that just came out within the last week does have an index, but that also is not thorough. I began on a Word file doing an index of the first two chapters and ran out of memory because we don't need just a name index to this. It has to be topical, and so there's work yet to be done on that. It, in large part, at the rear of the body, over 100 pages, is a notes section. The problem with the notes section is that, for the most part, it is self-referential. It refers to testimony taken by the commission in private, to documents not yet released, and to material that no one can see. At least the Warren report was released with 26 volumes of evidence. It wasn't all the evidence, but it was some of it. And there had been a discussion between Hale Boggs, one of the commissioners, and Alan Dulles, another commissioner, former head of the CIA, where Boggs said, well, do you think we ought to just put out the report without none of the evidence? Won't it look a little fishy? And Mr. Dulles says, go ahead and print some of it. Nobody will read it anyway. Mm-hmm. But I guess they've learned now that some of us will read it. And so we get a report with footnotes that go nowhere. There were over 2,000 interviews. There were 80 staff members that corresponded between themselves. There were 9 investigative teams. We don't know the nature of this final record, if we can get it loose, because much of the testimony privately and some in public was not taken under oath. And also, we were told that much of it was not transcribed, much of it was not directly recorded, and in many cases, merely notes were taken. That was officially told us to be the case with 4 hours of private testimony with Condoleezza Rice, even though the 15 hours with Richard Clark was fully transcribed and recorded. And it was certainly the case with the Cheney and Bush interviews, which had notes that only one person was designated to be able to write, and those notes had to be turned over to the White House for vetting before they'd be taken back to the commission that presumably sat and heard the hearing. And that kind of secrecy and lack of transparency and lack of sunshine approach to this has made it almost impossible to have an objective external review of the forensic and unclassified data, which is still not released. We wrote to the commission as 911 Citizens Watch and suggested that on release of documents, that all unclassified forensics should be released immediately, and on the classified, that they should use the new standards adopted under the JFK Assassination Record Review Board. That means only a living agent being compromised, a current source or method of intelligence being compromised, a privacy agreement with an individual, or a foreign government agreement. Those are the four categories under which something could be postponed for release. Nothing else. Much more constricted than the Freedom of Information Act. And we asked for them to call for expedited release of the classified materials under that standard. We won a small victory, I think, in that the documents have now been sent to the National Archives for release in 4.5 years rather than the standard anywhere between 20 and 50 years is possible for a congressional investigation. So it's a shorter period. Interestingly enough, it's dated January 2nd, 2009, when the current administration can't remain in power. So I found that interesting. But as it functioned, the commission was exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. And because these records are generated by a legislative branch, they're currently exempt. Interestingly enough, there's a legal possibility to effect a mandatory review of a classified document put into the 4.5 year delay, but there's no way to review an unclassified document for release. Of course, you'd have to know the classified document existed to get the review and what agency it came from, but maybe you'd find it in the notes. And the other option is to get a congressional reversal and release of this material. The other problem with this report is it is jointly written by the independent Commission and the White House. Governor Keene said that they took pains to create, before its release, an unclassified or a classified version of a report that would pass White House vetting. And in order to do that, they forwarded the draft chapters to the White House for pre-vetting. The standard procedure for an independent commission is that they release a report if it has intelligence issues involved. The White House would do the vetting along with the agencies, and then they'd come out with a final report that might be redacted. If you think back to the joint inquiry report of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, it's redacted. It has holes in it. Well, those holes tell you something. You know, they indicate areas, at least, that are left out for a reason or what sorts of things. This has no redaction because it's pre-redacted. And so this is essentially not an independent document. It's a document that was co-edited by the White House and the Commission, and it suffers from that as well. Now, Senators Dodd and Lieberman and Representative Shays asked and formally requested that the report include, if not answer, the questions compiled over time by the family groups. And it did neither. It answers a few, it leaves many unanswered, and it did. They said at least put the questions in as an addendum. They didn't do that. But they can be found online at their 911independentcommission.gov site, and I know some family members are compiling lists of others. This is based, I believe, because of the flawed commission process, on incorrect assumptions, incomplete testimony and evidence, major omissions in the record, and unsupported conclusions. And the recommendations that come from all that are similarly poorly informed. Only the recommendations so far getting any challenge. Interestingly enough, I mentioned Thompson's timeline as an antidote to this report. Another antidote is the commission record itself, a combination of testimony and staff statements. And when you begin to go through those, you will find contradictions in their own record with what they've decided in the report. Unlike the Warren Commission, which was characterized as a rush to judgment, I would characterize this as a rush to exoneration. It takes the attitude that this is all a systemic failure, which means that there's no way to have direct accountability. There were no reprimands or demotions that resulted from these failures. No courts of inquiry or court-martial in the military where you can be court-martialed for wrecking a Jeep. And with their own building attack, no line of duty inquiry. In fact, people were more often promoted than demoted in relation to the events of 9/11. A lack of appropriate preparation or response to the warnings and opportunities and the events of 9/11 is unchallenged. And naming these names is not, in my view, a witch hunt, but a probative approach that begins to put people on the carpet in terms of their own accountability and then shows you which part is systemic and which part is individual so that you can trace it down in a normal investigation. But their attitude led them at the beginning to take much of the testimony, not even under oath. And when challenged on that by the families and 911 Commission, they told us, Governor Keene and Hamilton told us, that they felt people would be more forthcoming if they weren't under oath. And we said that's a little counterintuitive to the way most investigations operate. So we did eventually sort of shame them into having people raise their hand. And we did an ad campaign saying that Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Clinton, and Gore should all be called into public and testify under oath, and to do anything less was to dishonor the dead. And so they didn't get everybody in there, but it did cause them to at least start acting like they were investigating something.
That's right.
And the failures at the command structure level have also not been addressed by the commission, even though they're pointed at. The law required that the commission be available for 60 days for congressional oversight hearings. And there were special sessions this summer and ones going on even today, I think, focusing on their recommendations, but not their process or their conclusions. And they have now sort of transformed themselves into a new thing called the 9/11 Public Disclosure, which is a nonprofit organization that will take pairs of commissioners and send them around the country to have public discussions. This may be a way to at least begin to have the public ask questions directly about some of these contradictions. I've had trouble getting any schedule of appearances out of them, but I'm working on it. But there will be additional access for public input. And an objective assessment is going to be difficult given the lack of the record, the concealment or destruction of the forensic evidence, pretty much what we have is standing court suits, our own investigations, and the ongoing investigation on the building collapses by the National Standards Group. So, but there are some ongoing investigations and could be others initiated on specific aspects. This is called a consensus, a bipartisan consensus, but the consensus of history is not just bipartisan at the upper levels of power. It has to be agreed to on a nonpartisan basis of the lowest levels of power in a society. And the facts of 9/11 belong to the American people as a whole, because until we really know the truth, we can't act on the truth. Martin Schatz, in one of the Kennedy assassination books, makes a very telling statement. He says that the political paralysis in America stems from the fact that we are allowed to believe anything, but to know nothing. And when we cannot know, we cannot act. Rumors and theories then replace the knowledge to act responsibly, and that's the exact opposite of a democratic process. Thomas Jefferson said he knew of no safe repository for the powers of a society beyond the people themselves. And he said that if you feel that they are unable to exercise their discretion in a wholesome fashion, that's 17th century for you, think them too stupid, the solution is not to take the power from them, but to inform their discretion. So that's why Jefferson realized that given a choice between a government without a newspaper or a newspaper without a government, he would always take the latter. Because the flow of information and access to information is more critical to the democratic process than the government that's put in power to enact it. We don't have that here, unfortunately. We have less and less of us. The task ahead is to investigate the work on the report and these monographs as they continue, to monitor the process of these legislative branch hearings, to establish the groundwork for and rationale for a People's Truth Commission, because if this commission has done its work, why should we have an additional one? Many of us here, I'm sure, know why we want one, but the general public would have to be convinced that this is flawed, to challenge the assumptions of the commission and Congress in the hearings and decisions they're making, and then to begin, and I hope the commission does this, not only address the facts of 9/11, but as the 9/11 commission did, address the recommendations and get into the real questions that lie behind American foreign policy in the last 50 years. What constitutes real security in this country? What is the balance between civil liberties and security? What is the role of militarism and intelligence in this society? What does it mean that we're going to go into an ongoing war for 60 years of the rest of our lives? Is that the proper response? And also, a basic question I'd ask is, what is the role of covert operations in the past and now in the future that I believe led into the situation we now live in and are not a solution to it? And instead, we're getting silent assent on many of these questions and no structural critique from this 9/11 commission. So it's left to investigative journalists and researchers, the international press sources and whistleblowers. They have to both educate the public to these contradictions and the credibility of this report to justify further inquiry, and also push for release of the full record so that we can do ongoing research. The commission itself was limited in time and budget. They spent way more money on the 9 deaths in the Challenger crash than they did on the 3,000 deaths. No family members were appointed. It was obstructed actively from its beginning by the executive branch. It had limited access to the record and to documents. Even the joint inquiry hearings, which 2 of the commission members sat in on, the record of those hearings was denied to them at first. It was exempt from the Federal Advisory Act, so no families or citizens could serve in a formal advisory position. And it was rife with conflicts of interest. We detail those in our preliminary report, but one of the major ones was the executive director, Philip Zelikow, a person who was challenged by the librarian for the JFK Library on a book that he wrote based on tapes made available from the library of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this librarian said that Zelikow's work couldn't be trusted by any scholar or student, that his transcription of these tapes was so faulty that you couldn't rely on it. And what they did was undermine the truth of the tapes, which he had listened to, which showed that Kennedy, almost alone in many cases, stood against the Joint Chiefs and the rest of his cabinet in not wanting to go to nuclear war. But this person, Zelikow, is part of the Miller Center, which pushes respect for the president and has created the new version of White House press conferences where people are pre-selected. He was also very tight with Condoleezza Rice and co-authored books with her. He was appointed, and the families didn't know this till much later, as part of the transitional team for the Bush administration, the National Security Advisory Group. He sat in on the meetings with Sandy Berger and Richard Clark where the imminent warnings were given. And when the families found this out, they said he should step down. The response of Keene and the commissioners was, well, he has had to recuse himself at certain points in the investigation. In fact, both he and Jamie Gorelick, one of the commissioners, were called as witnesses to their own commission. And the conflicts were so rife that Keene, in exonerating him, said, we will all have to recuse ourselves at some point in this investigation. That's,
John?
That's the chair talking
can
about
can take 30 seconds
itself.
To wrap up, and then
okay.
We've got to get the Q&A.
There's more to it, but it was a flawed process that led to flawed conclusions. And I did present a report today to you covering some of these, along with an exhaustive comparative timeline on the four flights and a bibliography. There's more work to do, but I think the key areas that will bear fruit in terms of a commission investigation are to challenge this idea that this was an intelligence failure and put it into its proper historical framework of a state-level, sophisticated covert operation. And the history of those covert operations through the last five administrations, starting with Carter and Brzezinski in the operations of the Mujahideen and also the Contragate scandal. And many of the Contragators are back in power. These were financed jointly by U.S. and Saudi intelligence, Pakistani ISI, drug money, and Otto Reich and Poindexter and Powell himself. All of these and others in the current administration were part of these covert operations that I believe led into the current situation we're in. So taking a look at that, taking a basic look at the suspects in the plot, I would argue we do not yet know the true identity of the 19 people on the planes. I don't believe that they didn't get on the plane, but I believe that when you don't know their true identity, to have a report like this track them back through time encourages in what's called in intelligence parlance a legend. It's like the false Oswalds. They go someplace, they use a particular identity, they establish a trail that you are meant to follow, but it's a trail that gives you false sponsorship for the event. And in covert operations, you spend more time on that false sponsorship than you do on the event itself. Were we unprepared? I approached Richard Shelby when the Joint Inquiry Report came out, and I asked him, did you find instances where planes had been used as weapons or used as weapons by these terrorist groups? He smiled because I had quoted Condoleezza Rice saying it was so outside the box no one could possibly have imagined. She backed off from that in her testimony saying, well, they knew, but I didn't know, which questions her competence to be the National Security Advisor, I would think. But he said, oh, yes, we found numerous instances of that. And then I said, well, did your inquiry find instances of preparations made in relation to these things? He literally blanched, his face turned, he stepped back, he said, can't get into that, walked away from the podium. Graham took the next question, and he came back to the podium, Shelby, and before asking the next question, pointed at me and said, and on advice of counsel, my answer to your question is no.
Okay, John.
Well,
John, I hate to cut you off, but in the interest of time, I just want to get.
That's all right.
I could hear him all day, of course, as all of you can, I'm sure. But we.
All right. Well, I just the undefended skies of 9/11 will bear fruit. FAA and NORAD and these timelines are wrong, and the Mineta testimony at 9:25 of Cheney discussing with a young lieutenant an order unidentified. He says, sir, the plane is 50 miles out, it's 30 miles out, it's 10 miles out. Does the order still stand at each juncture? Cheney snaps at 10 miles out and says, of course, the order still stands. This is before the Pentagon is hit. This is in reference to Flight 77. If this is a shoot-down order, and all the testimony says shoot, no shoot-down order till after the Pentagon is hit, if this is a shoot-down order, what's delaying it? And if it's not, what is the order that's concerning the young lieutenant as the plane approaches the Pentagon?
Thank you. Thank you, John.
John Judge, testifying before the 9/11 Citizens Commission in New York City.
We will go to a question and answer period now for the commissioners, and perhaps I know Dr. Khan is very interested in posing some of these medical questions to Ms. Orkin. But first, I want to go to Commissioner McElvain.
All right, well, first question to Jenna. Who do you think put the pressure about getting everything open? Was it Wall Street on the government or the government on Wall Street? Yeah. I mean, can we put a blame somewhere? Did it come from, you know, a group of people?
Well, I'm not any more informed, probably less, than many other people about how Wall Street works with the government. But do you think there's a conflict between them?
No.
I think they were in agreement. Let's get Wall Street up and running, and that's, you know, their primary objective, their first priority.
Jenna, can you just also, you touched on the insurance companies.
Yeah.
What interest did they have in sort of downplaying the role of a dangerous atmosphere?
That they wouldn't have to pay for the cleanups.
That's a huge incentive. Mm. And one more question, just for the audience. Where could they get information about the facts for their morbidity rates and the incidence of asthma and reactive airways diseases and other things? Are those being tabulated by a private medical agency, a city agency, you? Where can you get those?
Well, there are a lot of studies being done. There's one done by Dr. Anthony Zima of Stony Brook and the Charles B. Wang Community Health Center in Manhattan, Department of Epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Health. It showed an increase in asthma rates and severity among pediatric patients living within a radius of 5 miles of Ground Zero after 9/11. There's a study at Mount Sinai being done. There was an article by Andrew Revkin in the New York Times called Smoke and Dust at World Trade Center is Linked to Smaller Babies, so that the advice initially given that pregnant women need take no extra precautions turns out to have been false. A lot of people, Dr. Joan Reidman is studying it, and many others.
Okay, thank you.
My mother used to be a nurse, retired nurse, and when these images of Ground Zero were broadcast to all of us, she picked up the phone to me and called me and said, Cynthia, those workers are going to have health effects. Now, this is, you know, my mom, who is like so far away, recognizing that there's going to be a problem here. Tell me, in your legal case, who are your defendants?
I'm so hesitant to talk about the legal case. EPA, Christy Todd Whitman, Marianne Horinka, who was under Whitman. It's essentially focused on EPA in general and specific individuals within EPA.
And so then what about the role of the city of New York in its responsibility for protecting its citizens?
You're now talking about residents. You're not talking about Ground Zero workers. Essentially, everybody took their cues from EPA. And once EPA declared the air to be safe, that was the signal that you behave accordingly. And so business as usual was what happened.
Well, couldn't people who were charged with the responsibility of protecting the lives of the people here question EPA?
In general, the government didn't question. The citizens, the activists did question to a large extent and did protest. And, you know, Juan Gonzalez came out with an article on October 26th, which was the first, I think, major article that there really were problems. But there was such a kind of sense of we've got to show the terrorists, get back on the horse, you know, that people were drowned out if they raised any such questions. I know the kids at Stuyvesant felt it was unpatriotic to raise those sorts of questions, and most did not. And I think that was the general sense at the time.
Just in fairness to the workers, I mean, I happen to have been there the morning of the 12th or 13, I forget which one, a day, like 24 hours after the event. I can tell you all the workers there, there was such a frenzy to get there and do something that oftentimes we were actually reprimanded by senior officials for not wearing respirators, not wearing protective gear, but for them it was just a question of getting in there and doing what we can. So it wasn't, no one was thinking about those terms then, but at this point, in terms of chronic exposure to things where really you get in trouble with health, with chronic exposure, days and days and days, weeks and weeks and weeks, that's where these issues are probably most important, and that's why I think they're being neglected. As far as the EPA is concerned, that holds as much esteem in my eyes as the FDA. So both of these agencies have been compromised multiple times due to fiscal interests, and it has a historical precedent. So.
Commissioner Dr. Faiz Khan.
Okay. With that, we will hear from Mr. Springman, who is next. Come on out. Attorney Michael Springman. And then after Springman, Thompson, and Rupert, and then we'll have questions. Attorney Springman, do you swear to tell this commission the truth?
I do indeed, under the laws of perjury of the United States of America and the sovereign state of New York.
Okay, Mr. Springman.
I'm Mike Springman. In the past, I had been a Foreign Service officer, diplomat, with the Department of State. I'm currently an attorney in private practice in Washington, D.C. And I'm quite happy to be here. I'm surprised to be here because last year the Justice Department seized my email accounts and put a client of mine on the no-fly list. So I wasn't quite sure what I would run into at Dulles Airport today, and alhamdulillah, I got on the airplane with no trouble at all. Mm. But I'm here to talk to you about visas. Visas issued to terrorists at the CIA's consulate at Jeddah, principal city of the Hejaz in the western part of Saudi Arabia. Recently, 3 years ago, we had 15 of the 19 hijackers get visas from the CIA's consulate at Jeddah. They didn't get them from London or Frankfurt or Cairo. They got them from Jeddah. They didn't get them from Dahran in the eastern province. They didn't get them from Riyadh, the capital of the country. They got them from the American Consulate General in Jeddah. And I thought that was very peculiar. And I had thought that all of the hell that I had raised almost 15 years ago and in the intervening period might have done some good. I was wrong. When I went out to Jeddah in 1987, I started hearing about problems that they had there. They had issues with servants and issues with politically important people, and nobody could explain to me exactly what the problem was. I heard it from the ambassador. I heard it from a couple of people in the administrative offices for that section of the world in the State Department. But when I got there, I started getting pressure to issue visas to people who really had no ties either to Saudi Arabia or their own country. As an example, a Sudanese refugee, he couldn't go back to the Sudan, he was unemployed in Saudi Arabia, yet the political officer wanted him to get a visa to go to Washington, D.C. I objected strenuously, and the chief of the consular section issued him the visa. And when I asked him why, he said, well, for national security reasons. As time went on, it got worse. I was being pressured by the Consul General, J. Philip Frares, by a consular officer, I'm sorry, not a consular officer, a commercial officer, and various other people throughout the consulate. We need a visa for this guy. It wasn't a visa for my friend. It wasn't a visa for a prospective business contact. It was for somebody like the two Pakistanis who were going to a trade show in the United States. They couldn't name the trade show. They couldn't name the city in which it was being held. But a CIA case officer concealed in the commercial section demanded a visa for these people within the hour of my refusing them. And I said, no. They can't tell me where they're going. They can't tell me why they're going. The law is very clear. These are intending immigrants unless and until they can prove otherwise, and they haven't done it. Do you have some information that was not available to me when they applied? He said, no. I said, they're not going. He went to Justice Stevens, the chief of the consular section, and got a visa for these guys. This went on all the time I was there. It was the consul general, it was these other people, and it finally got to the point where Jay Freres would tell me, if you want a career in the Foreign Service, you'll issue this visa. My staff said, don't be stupid, Mike. Give them the visa and then write down on the application form who ordered that the visa be given. I kept a file on this. And when I left Saudi Arabia, the file was shredded. Nobody knows who did it. Nobody knows who gave the order. Nobody knows why. But I complained to Justice Stevens. I complained to Stephanie Smith, the counselor for consular affairs in Riyadh. And I said, well, you know, we have these problems, and you really ought to do this. And Stephanie suggested that when I went back to Washington, I should talk to the Bureau of Consular Affairs. Well, shortly before I left, the State Department has something called an inspection team come out. I'll try not to talk about jargon and inside government speak to you. It's basically a management practice to examine how a Foreign Service post is functioning. Does it do things according to the law? Does it do things according to regulation? Is there a more efficient way of doing this particular action? So I was told by a contact outside of the consulate, don't talk about this, don't talk about the visas. And if you do, you're going to lose your job. Well, I didn't think so, but I decided it would be smart not to talk too much about it. Well, when Joseph P. O'Neill came through, he pressured me for an hour to talk about this. And I said, no. He said, but I know this. And he simply ran through exactly everything I knew about the situation, plus a little bit more besides, and went on and on and on, and finally wore me down. Oh, it's going to help the efficiency of the Foreign Service, et cetera. So I told him this. Then things went from bad to worse. The Consul General was livid, wrote a remarkably negative efficiency report and said I shouldn't be in the Foreign Service at all. And I had been told that this was a visa scam, and it certainly seemed that way to me. I was told, look who needs the money. And the price supposedly for these visas was $2,500. And it was, you know, the king's barber servant to get a visa. Freres was seen filling out visa applications for people in the consulate. It was just absolutely incomprehensible to me. And people I talked to who had been there really didn't want to say much more about it. And it wasn't until I was out of the Foreign Service, when my appointment had been terminated for unspecified reasons, that I learned from three good sources. Joe Trento, the journalist, a fellow attached to a university in Washington, D.C., and a guy with expert knowledge on the Middle East who had worked for a government agency. They said, it's very simple. The CIA and its asset Osama bin Laden were recruiting terrorists for the Afghan war. They were sending them to the United States for training, for rewards, for whatever purpose, and then sending them on to Afghanistan, and most likely the problems they had with the liquor at the consulate, large amounts of it disappearing, it being sold at very high markups, and so forth, was being used to fund this. Well, that explained the whole thing. That explained why nobody wanted to talk to me about this. It explained why the file was shredded. And it explained why they were so mad at me, because I apparently had disrupted their way of pass and go and collecting $200 or more. Well, when I learned this, I went to the FBI. I went to Congress, the House Subcommittee on International Affairs, where I was told, what's the matter? Don't you like the CIA? I went to the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, the section charged with corruption in government and crooked officials. Didn't want to talk to me. I managed to write a few articles and get them published in Unclassified, the Bureau of the Association of National Security Alumni. when September 11th happened, Covert Action Quarterly published an account of this that I had written. Admittedly, it wasn't my best work, but it basically put down what I'm telling you folks right now. And then there was media interest. Not American media interest, but media interest from the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, RAI, Radio Televisione Italiana, the Italian radio and television service, Canal Plus, a French channel. Unfortunately, no Germans, even though I do know some German journalists. But the Washington Post, which I approached, the New York Times, which I approached, the Los Angeles Times, which I approached, couldn't be bothered to learn anything at all about this. They didn't ask me any questions. I did get a lunch from the Los Angeles Times, and they looked at some of the material I had. But that was as far as it went. The Associated Press did a short article when people in the government began, I think, getting embarrassed about reading about themselves. But the wire service article disappeared. Nobody ever said they'd seen it anywhere in the country. I've been interviewed by a couple of smaller, non-mainstream radio stations. About a year or two ago, I was on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now! With Greg Palast. But it's beginning to come out in the open. Greg Palast devoted a few paragraphs in his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Craig Unger's book, House of Bush, House of Saud, has a couple of paragraphs devoted to me and the situation in Jeddah. And Joe Trento is publishing a book next month, inshallah, called Prelude to Terror, which goes into detail on the situation at the CIA's consulate in Jeddah and how terrorists got their visas. But I think also this business of Visa Express that Joel Mallory and others have played up is something of a red herring or a little bit of misdirection. Saudis, people with Saudi passports, didn't have to appear in front of a consular officer. Their personal appearances were waived. It's a good way to get people past the visa officer who asks awkward questions like I did, because you put them in a pile and you send them through a reputable travel agent to the consulate. They did this in Latin America, according to Celvino Castillo, a drug enforcement agency officer. He said this was one of the agency's favorite tricks of slipping people into the country. But the difficulty is nobody wants to hear about this.
Mike, I'm going to just remind you one minute, okay?
1 minute? Okay.
Time, yeah.
All right. So basically, I think that the way to reform things and put an end to this is to stop the secrecy. My Freedom of Information Act request and its lawsuit was sealed as a threat to national security. It was resealed within the last 2 weeks by Royce Lamberth, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. He's on the panel of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act judges. So what we really got to do is abolish the CIA's Directorate of Operations, the people who overthrow governments and assassinate politicians the U.S. doesn't like, and we've got to cut their budget of all the intelligence services by 25% this year.
Former Foreign Service officer Michael Springman before the 9/11 Citizens Commission.
And now we will hear from Paul Thompson, the famous author of the 911 timeline, which we all have used as a reference. Do you swear? Yeah, raise your right hand. The standard has been set now. Do you swear to tell us the truth here today?
Of course.
Thank you very much.
So I want to talk about two things today. So I'll just go straight into it since I don't have a lot of time. First thing I want to talk about is the foreign intelligence warnings about 9/11. Some of you may have seen out in back, I have this this book that has just come out a couple days ago called The Terror Timeline. And this is based on my website. And the material I'm going to talk about today is based on what I've done on the website and now is in the book. And everything in there is from mainstream source material, CBS News, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, that kind of material. So I want to preface that everything I'm saying here, everything I'm going to be saying, is coming from those kinds of sources. And the first thing I want to start with is a quote from President Bush. Just a few months ago, he said, had I any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes in the buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country. So he didn't have any inkling whatsoever. And now I'm going to tell you something I think was probably the most significant thing that came out of the 9/11 Commission, and it really got ignored. And just briefly mentioned in one of their staff statements, it said that in the beginning of summer of 2001, Osama bin Laden actually started publicly talking about the 9/11 plot. He would go to mosques and he would speak in front of large crowds in Afghanistan, talking to his followers, talking to local, local people who are coming to the mosque. And according to the 9/11 Commission, he actually would say things in his speeches, like in one speech he said that people should pray for the success of an upcoming attack involving 20 martyrs. Or another person said that bin Laden told them that the U.S. would be hit by a terrorist attack and thousands would die. So there's this really kind of, very almost open secret about the 9/11 attacks. So another example would be John Walker Lynn. You might have heard of him. He's kind of they call him the Marin County Taliban guy. He went over there, joined Al-Qaeda. In a matter of days, he learned all about the 9/11 attacks. He learned that there were going to be all these different airplanes involved. So, in other words, it was just a very, very widely talked about thing in Afghanistan. So then what we see is that all these foreign governments picked up on this and started warning the U.S. It also says in the 9/11 Commission report that this knowledge, this foreknowledge, was so extensive that it spread throughout the radical fundamentalist network throughout the world. So people all over the world, including in the United States now, were getting details of the plot months in advance. And this is why, I think this is the main reason why, we see now all these governments start warning the U.S. So I'm just going to run really quickly and just tell you some of the warnings that came out. And remember that all of these are mentioned in very mainstream sources, New York Times, Washington Post, this kind of stuff. And none of the things I'm going to talk about today, except for what I just said, but all these foreign intelligence warnings, none of these are talked about in the 9/11 Commission. They've just completely ignored all of them. These reports never happened. So also, all of these things I'm going to talk about all are from 3 months before 9/11, June, July, August. All these warnings start coming up. So the British, they warn the U.S. They say Al-Qaeda is in, quote, the final stages of a very serious attack on a Western country. And then they also warn that an Al-Qaeda attack will involve multiple hijackings. So it'll be a single attack, multiple airplanes hijacked. Then Egypt, they warn, and this to me is the most astonishing warning, also in the way it was just completely ignored. It was on 60 Minutes on CBS, just mentioned briefly. And I'll quote it for you. It says, in late July, Egyptian intelligence says it received a report from one of its operatives in Afghanistan that 20 Al-Qaeda members had slipped into the U.S. and four of them had received flight training on light aircraft. To the Egyptians, pilots of small planes didn't sound terribly alarming, but they passed on the message to the CIA, fully expecting Washington to request information. The request never came. So if that's not... we know there were 19 hijackers instead of 20. There were four training on light aircraft. And again, it's not surprising given what, bin Laden was saying to people. And we know that Egypt had a mole in Afghanistan and gave other good information. So really remarkable that nothing was done. Then later, a few weeks later, the Egyptians warned that this operation that was going forward were in the advanced stages. And this is according to the Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak himself. Then Germany. Germany warned that terrorists would use airplanes as weapons to attack, quote, American and Israeli symbols which stick out. Then Jordan warned that a major attack using aircraft is planned inside the United States. And by the way, they even said the name of the code name of the attack, which was the Big Wedding, which turned out to be the code name of the 9/11 attack. Russia warned that suicide pilots were training for attacks on U.S. targets. And then the head of Russian intelligence later stated, "We clearly warned the U.S. on several occasions, but they did not pay the necessary attention." And then the Taliban, actually, one of the foreign minister of the Taliban himself was kind of upset with the other leaders, didn't want the attack to go forward, so he warned that Al-Qaeda was going to plan an imminent huge attack, quote-unquote, inside the U.S. that would kill thousands of people. And funnily enough, the excuse in the news reports about why this wasn't taken seriously is, as I said, because the U.S. intelligence agencies were suffering from warning fatigue. They were getting so many warnings that they just couldn't handle it anymore. Even Argentina gave a warning because not a lot of people know this, but there's a little sort of a pocket of Al-Qaeda in the Argentina area. France gave a warning. It's an echo of an Israeli warning. And I'll tell you the Israeli warning. They warned, well, they had two separate warnings. First one, they said 50 to 200 Al-Qaeda terrorists are inside the U.S. and planning an imminent, quote, major assault, unquote, aimed at a, quote, large-scale target, unquote. And then this is, and actually this is probably the most remarkable warning, is that according to Der Spiegel and some other newspapers in Europe, a few weeks before the attack, before 9/11, Israel actually gave the U.S. a list of 19 terrorists. Now, we don't know if that's the exact same 19. However, the reports specify that four of the names were the same, including Mohammed Atta, Marwan al-Shihi, and the two hijackers in San Diego, al-Midar and al-Hazmi. So these are the leaders of the 9/11 plot. And according to Der Spiegel, all these names were given to the U.S. government. Morocco gave a warning saying that Al-Qaeda is planning large-scale operations in New York City in the fall of 2001, possibly targeting the World Trade Center. So I could go on. These are just some selected warnings that I've given. But as you can see, there's so many warnings that, in fact, in the middle of August, Kofor Black, who's the head of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, he was speaking at a convention of counterterrorist officials in a public venue, and he said, quote, "We are going to be struck soon. Many Americans are going to die, and it could be in the U.S." And later on, he said that the top leaders were unwilling to act unless they were told that the attack was coming within the exact day, and here is what they are going to hit. So in other words, he's saying that basically the leaders didn't care to stop the attack, made no moves to defend the United States unless they were told exactly the day and the location of what the attack would be. And in fact, we can see that the Bush administration did absolutely nothing despite all these warnings. There was one thing that I found interesting in the 9/11 commission hearings is that Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, who is still the Transportation Secretary for Bush, he was asked, so can you point to one thing that the Bush administration did before 9/11 that helped safeguard the U.S.? And he said, no, wasn't a single thing. So that's the first part of my talk. The second part I want to talk about the issue of Pakistan. I could also talk about Saudi Arabia, but I don't have time for that. But between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, these are the two countries that you think would have given the U.S. warnings. I mean, here we're getting Argentina, all these countries, Morocco are warning the U.S. But, you know, the two countries, Pakistan, extremely closely tied to the Taliban. They basically, you know, created the Taliban, and it was, Taliban was their puppet, as even the 9/11 Commission has stated. And then Saudi Arabia, where all the hijackers are from, Osama bin Laden's from, we don't get any warnings from those two countries. And I think there's significant evidence that the Pakistani intelligence agency actually had a very direct role in the plot. It's a very unusual intelligence agency. It's called the ISI. And it got very rich off of drug money. So rich from all the opium and heroin coming from Afghanistan and moving through Pakistan that it's self-funding. So it's basically politically autonomous, and people call it a state within a state. It can basically do whatever it wants. Some people say that the ISI is more powerful than the actual Pakistani government. And as the Wall Street Journal has said, quote, despite their clean chins and pressed uniforms, the ISI men are as deeply fundamentalist as any bearded fanatic. The ISI created the Taliban as their own instrument and still supports it. So there's essentially, you cannot see a difference between the ISI and the Taliban, and in my opinion, Al-Qaeda. They all are essentially the same group of people. And in fact, there was a some U.S. reporters went to Afghanistan just right before 9/11, and they said everything here that we've seen, everything the Taliban has, the water, the oil, the food, everything's coming from the ISI. They're just complete puppets of the ISI. So I'm going to run through just a couple things really quickly here, some key characters to kind of keep in mind. Randy Glass is involved in a U.S. Sting operation. He was a criminal himself, got involved in a sting operation with the FBI and the, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And in 1999, there was an ISI agent, and they were recording the conversation as part of their sting operation. And this ISI agent was within sight of the World Trade Center. He pointed to the World Trade Center, and he said, "Those towers are coming down." And he repeated that statement on several occasions. And this is, you know, this evidence has been recorded on tape. So we can see, this is interesting, because some people say that people didn't know that the towers would be completely destroyed. But here we are, even in 1999, stating with assurance that the towers are going to be completely destroyed. And I could go into a lot more about Randy Glass, but there's a big sordid history there of the ISI's involvement in even trying to buy nuclear weapons to give to Al-Qaeda. Now, another character to keep in mind is Syed Sheikh. He's a very, very important character, and I think he's really the key to understanding a lot about 9/11. He's famous for being the killer of the reporter Daniel Pearl. You may remember in 2002 he got very brutally kidnapped and you know, publicly executed, basically. And but it appears that Syed Sheikh actually was one of the key funders for the 9/11 attacks. And so I'll read a quote from the London Times about him. It says, "Syed Sheikh is no ordinary terrorist, but a man who has connections that reach high into Pakistan's military and intelligence elite and into the innermost circles of Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda organization. He, in fact, was so tied in that bin Laden called him his favorite son, and he was even talking of replacing bin Laden someday. And yet, he was also an ISI agent." So I can't go into all the details, but there's a lot of evidence showing that he actually trained some of the hijackers in terrorism techniques, and he directly funded the attacks. Now, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called 9/11 mastermind, he was also Syed Sheikh's boss. They knew each other. They, for instance, they both participated in the Daniel Pearl killing. Now, Robert Fisk, who, as you may well know, is a very famous journalist, he said, like Saeed Sheikh, Mohammed was an ISI asset. Indeed, anyone handed over by the ISI these days is almost certainly a former employee of the ISI, whose control of the Taliban amazed even the Pakistani government. And then there's General Mahmoud Ahmed, and he's the head of the ISI. The Wall Street Journal and other media outlets reported in a month after 9/11 that General Mahmoud Ahmed, head of the ISI, ordered $100,000 to go from Saeed Sheikh to Mohammed Atta, the head hijacker. So we see a direct link from the head of the ISI to the head of the hijackers. And this remarkable evidence has really been ignored. And this last fact leads to all kinds of interesting connections to the U.S. because it so happens that General Ahmad, on the morning of 9/11, was actually meeting with Senator Bob Graham, Democratic Senator, Porter Goss, House Representatives guy who's now up for being the new head of the CIA, and John Kyle, another senator. And in the weeks before this, these same three U.S. politicians were in Pakistan talking to General Ahmad. We don't know what they were talking about. I certainly would like to know. So I'm running out of time, but another interesting figure that I think also points to very interesting directions is a guy called General Hamid Ghul, who's a former head of the ISI. And a recent report from UPI suggested that this Hamid Ghul was actually the master planner for Osama bin Laden. And one reason this is very interesting is because Richard Clark has stated, you know, the counterterrorism czar for Bush and Clinton, stated that in 1999, they intercepted a message between Hamid Ghul and some of the leaders of the Taliban where he said, you know that time Clinton tried to hit you with a missile, late 98, don't worry, Clinton is not planning on doing it again, and even if he does, I'll warn you again like I gave you advance warning on the last time. So this to me suggests that there is some sort of collaboration between people within the U.S. government and people in the ISI, and this General Hamid Ghul is being fingered as one of the masterminds of the 9/11 plot. The 9/11 Commission has covered up this information. There was actually an article in the LA Times that said that some people on the commission said that the Pakistanis were, quote, up to their eyeballs, unquote, in involvement with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and that the commission findings that were actually released were, quote, only the tip of the iceberg, unquote, on these connections. Now, Daniel, I'll say just one more thing. Daniel Ellsberg, of the famous Pentagon Papers whistleblower, he said that, quote, it seems to me quite plausible that Pakistan was quite involved in 9/11. To say Pakistan, to me, is to say the CIA, because it's hard to say that the ISI would know something that the CIA had no knowledge of. So I hope that we can figure out these connections and bring these people to justice. Thank you very much.
Paul Thompson, author of The 9/11 Timeline, testifying before the 9/11 Citizens Commission hearings on September 9th in New York City. We'll continue with the hearings next week. Thanks to 911truth.org and 9/11 Citizens Watch for making this audio available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.